We know that no one can succeed alone. Since the Second World War, more than 120,000 Norwegian women and men have served shoulder to shoulder with friends and allied forces. They have participated in almost 100 missions, fighting for values on which we build our societies. A bridge of trust has been built between our brothers in arms and our allied countries. Some soldiers did not make it home, and many suffered injuries. A few have been honored as war heroes. None should be forgotten.
So welcome to another episode in Friends and Allies, where we try to enlighten the strong bonds between Norway and her allies around the world. And today we're going back in time and talking about the relationship between Britain and Norway. And with me today I have John Andrews. Welcome to you, sir.
Kind of you to invite me.
You're from England, and you told me you were originally from Kent.
Yes, that's correct. As far as I know, we weren't occupied by the Vikings, so we can't blame you for that.
No, that's very nice of you. But you were raised in Nigeria.
Yes, I come from, I'm incredibly old, so I came from a generation of Englishmen or Brits, though it wasn't unusual for our parents to serve abroad. That was slightly unusual in my case, as my father was in the oil industry. So I was fortunate enough to grow up in Nigeria and Ghana at a very interesting period in their history.
How long did you stay there?
Slightly difficult to give you a straight answer because I was there for a period of, I think, 7 or 8 years. But for a large proportion of that, I would fly home by myself to England to go to my boarding school.
Boarding school, that's a concept we don't have too much of here in Norway, but essentially, meaning you were staying at the school, living there.
Probably explains why you Norwegians are very well balanced compared to my generation of Englishmen. I mean, they existed because in my case, you could go to what were army schools in both Nigeria and Ghana up to a certain age. But after the age of 9, you had to fly back to England. So boarding schools, which still exist, essentially, you arrived on day 1, you were let out for a weekend walk, but everybody there was, you know, someone whose parents lived many thousand miles away, and they existed to make sure you could have as nearly a normal as upbringing as possible.
So you were basically locked into that school the whole week?
Yes, we didn't actually have barbed wire around the edge of it, but funnily enough, for someone like me, who England wasn't quite a foreign country, if I was going to run away, it would have been quite a challenging expedition. But to get to Nigeria from England would actually have been challenging. So no, you were effectively in your own little world.
Can you recall, I mean, flying from Africa to England at that time, it wasn't like a 3-hour trip. Can you recall some of your experience? You were 9 when you started flying.
I mean, it's interesting you talk to people now who've got young children, and the concept that your parents would take you to the airport, put you on the aircraft, where, to be fair, you'd probably find that most of the people on the aircraft were contemporaries of your own in terms of age. We could strip an aircraft of everything saleable within 10 minutes of takeoff because we knew when we got to the other end it was a market of memorabilia. So the cabin crew must have been absolutely terrified. But when I began doing it with an airline called British Overseas Airways Corporation, which later becomes BA, the routes would vary, but the very first flights were in a Stratocruiser, which is a piston job. So typically you'd fly Lagos, Kano, it would depend, Cairo, maybe Rome, maybe Paris, then London. So effectively you were talking a journey, I mean, I can't remember exactly, but 20 hours plus. But for us, it was perfectly normal. Now, the idea of children being put on an aircraft alone, in fact, I believe the last British airline which allowed unaccompanied children stopped doing it about 5 years for insurance purposes. But for us, it was normality. So people say, you know, don't you feel rejected that you went to boarding school? Weren't you scared? No, because at the age of 9, it was rather like the first time you wore long sleeve shirts or long trousers in Africa. You know, it was a process of transition. And it's just a good example how things change.
Did you have any close encounters on one of those trips? I mean, you must have a different perspective.
Well, the one story I will tell, which probably won't offend anyone now, is I remember the first time I flew across the Sahara, when rather unfortunately I looked out the window and the aircraft was in flames. So, being very public spirited, I felt I needed to tell fellow passengers, so stood up and announced the fact we were on fire. And I still remember an absolutely superb BOAC pilot coming back and sitting next to me, looking out of the window and pointing out that was a piston engine, and piston engines, the cowling glows red. The sparks and the flames I saw were actually the exhaust. And I still remember him saying he was very grateful. But the next time I thought the aircraft was on fire and we were all going to die, perhaps I could tell the pilot before I informed all the other passengers. Because on the whole, it worried them. And I've kept to that story ever since. I've never announced the aircraft was going to crash.
I think most of your fellow passengers will appreciate that. Okay, so after school, and then you continued your education, of course. Can you just drag us through it, and you ended up in the civil end of the service?
Well, I suppose again, this dates me, but I actually went to the London School of Economics when it was meant to be the centre of the revolution, and the cliche in those days was between the LSE and Sandhurst, we ruled the world. That clearly wasn't true. Of course, like most good stories, it's complete border dash because LSE, amazingly, had the highest proportion of Conservative voting students in London University. That is also the British expression, lies, damn lies and statistics. And that's another good example of a lie because, of course, you went to LSE if you were interested in politics. But it gave you a very good grounding in life because you realised that the press would be full of stories of student revolutionaries sitting in occupying buildings. Of course, if you were there, the reason you occupied the building was actually it was an excuse for a party. So it was always fascinating comparing the headlines with what you knew, what was going on. In fact, you know, this is where, well, if there are any of my left-wing friends still alive, they'll hate me for saying it. But interestingly, at the height of the so-called revolutionary, the library never closed. The sad part of it is, in my final year, people started coming to LSE because they'd believed the publicity. And you actually had people turning up who, you know, would try and close the library, to use a silly example. And it was just sad because, I mean, without boring you with the details, the reason LSE had that reputation is we had a close relationship with the Chicago School of Economics. So what had actually happened was Students for a Democratic Society, who were one of the very activist movements in America, because LSE, joking aside, was a leading academic institution for economics. A lot of people from Chicago came to LSE as postgraduates. It was those American postgraduates who kicked it off. Now, they did it for reasons you might disagree with, but they were legitimate. And I'll say the only point in making it sad when you start getting people turning up because they've read about it and they think they're revolutionary. So I was very glad to have been there. When I say whether you agree or disagree, people were doing it for reasons they believed in. After that, it all became a little bit sad because people were playing the part they thought they should be.
But you didn't turn revolutionary in any sort and attacking the Buckingham Palace and stuff?
As far as I know, I've never overthrown a government. So no, I'm afraid this is going to be a great disappointment to your listeners. I did not man the barricades. Although I was on the student newspaper and did organise some of the... whether I should tell the story, but there's a well-known film in Britain called Zulu, which is all about the Zulu War. I won't bore you with the details. Now, although it sounds very colonial, in fact, it's between the British Army and the Zulus, and one of the people playing the Zulus was Chief Bulawayo, and it was very, it paid respect to the fighting spirit of the Zulus. Anyway, the point of this story is, for reasons I don't quite remember, we showed this film. And I still remember how the audience split along national lines, not political lines, shall we say. And at the end of the film, I've never seen so many embarrassed extreme left-wingers who suddenly realized they'd been cheering on the wrong side in terms of their politics. So you look back and, you know, you have all these iconic memories.
But you continued that trip into the governmental part of the. But you never started as an economic in a
no.
huge company.
I mean, if you went to LSE, interestingly, from my point of view, I had an interest in international relations. In my generation, you had very few options. You could do peace studies, war studies, Soviet studies. But LSE was one of the very few which did international relations. So you did a BSc economics, but within that you specialized in international relations. So it was quite advantageous. Yeah, so a lot of my contemporaries, if you wanted to make a lot of money, clearly you did a pure economics degree, BSc econ with econometrics, and you went on to have a career in the city. But perhaps because of the way I had grown up, my main motivation for going there was international relations. Of course, LSE, even in that era, was a very international institution. So it wasn't just the quality of the academic degree, either, that it was. It was the opportunity to meet an extremely diverse, in every sense of the word, student population. So I have no regrets.
And when you entered your start of your career, did you have any thoughts of ending up as a figure of embodiment of the veterans organization that you are now facing?
No, I mean, I think I suspect I'm not unusual. Well, I suppose the difference is my generation to maybe some of the younger people who happen to be listening to this is we tended to assume that during our career we would have one, two jobs, maybe three. But on the whole, you expected to spend a fair chunk of your time with the organization you first joined. Now it's true to say people starting out on life, they have the expectation of maybe four, five, six, I don't know, generations. So, no, when I started out, it was working for the British government. And I joined the Ministry of Defence because it was an opportunity to see the world, the way the world operated from the inside, and in a very minor way, playing a part. For example, I was never attracted to academia because one of the things that drove me was to have a slightly more hands-on approach to the world than merely sitting back, firing from the outside into it.
And you did achieve your goal in traveling and seeing the world.
Yes, the world's probably not grateful for the fact, but I was lucky enough to have traveled a fair chunk of the world. I mean, one of the reasons I feel very sorry for the younger generation is I'm lucky enough, to have traveled places like Libya, actually been in places like Lebanon, both for work and holidays. Syria, I've been for both. I feel quite sorry for people now, how many parts of the world they will probably never get to see unless there is a quite phenomenal vol farce in terms of the international situation. So yes, I'm extremely lucky to have seen a fair chunk of the world, apart from Iran, who somehow never wanted to welcome me.
This was mainly during the Cold War. And how did you, working for the British government, look at that? I would say it was a cold but hot conflict.
Funny enough, the British, let's call it the military, although I make it very clear I've never been a member of the armed forces, so I'm a civilian. But if we use the British military as an analogue, there have always really been two British armies. It's been the British Army in Europe and then what was historically the British Army in India. But after Indian independence, there was then that part of the British Army which looked primarily to the world outside of Europe. So although, yes, I mean, for much of my career, the Cold War dominated, it so happened a lot of my time was also spent helping look after British interests elsewhere. So one was lucky enough, to travel to places like Cyprus or the Far East, Hong Kong, before I gave it back. So yes, the Cold War, it's very difficult to explain to people now. I mean, I remember we used to have, which I think is now declassified, an exercise, which was really World War III, And everyone would look forward to the moment that Britain, London was nuked, because that meant we could go home. So in a surreal way, you'd be looking at a watch. Oh, yes, London is wiped out in kind of 12 hours time, unless you had a place in the bunker. That meant endex. But it's very difficult to describe to younger people now that you just live with it. Similarly, you know, I was in London during the height of the IRA bombing campaign. You know, I think the closest bomb to me was only about 500 yards away, which was a suitcase bomb. And again, it's very difficult trying to get through to younger people that it became part of normality. Now, obviously, I'm too young to have been around people who lived through the Blitz, but it is interesting. I can remember talking to people and they said, you just got on with it. And I would argue the same way people say, how did you live under the threat of Armageddon? Well, you didn't think of it in those terms. Again, I'm too young to have been involved. But things like the Cuban Missile Crisis, obviously, when it hotted up, I'm sure that people who were in their 20s, it became a lot more real then. And I say with the IRA bombing campaign in London, to an outsider, I think, my God, how dare. But you got used to it, you know, it became, I can remember sitting on trains and you'd be asked to get off because there'd been a hoax bomb threat at the station. And it's amazing looking back how it just became part of life's routine.
Just to dwell a moment with the IRA era, to put it that way, were the British government looking differently at that conflict than they would do on other conflict, since it was internal?
Yes, I mean, you've put your finger on an absolutely crucial difference. You know, Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. And although, you know, it's not often talked about, I mean, one of the considerations you had to take in, there were people at the time who said, oh, we should just abandon Northern Ireland. Well, now, whilst clearly that would have been totally wrong for a whole host of reasons, what people forget is that some of the divisions that were in Northern Ireland between Protestant and Catholic, different traditions, were actually also reflected in parts of the British mainland. So although, as I say, the reasons for not leaving Northern Ireland were to do with the fact that we would only leave Northern Ireland if that's what, in terms of electoral votes, people wanted, people forget that Northern Ireland was reflected in cities like Glasgow or Liverpool. So yes, for the British government's point of view, this was never, whatever some people might think, viewed through the prism of, you know, our colonialism. It was viewed through the prism. A majority of people in Northern Ireland want to be part of the United Kingdom. And, you know, so for example, if you want to, you know, extreme example, you wouldn't get a campaign medal. Think of all the people of the British Army. It was never a war. You know, it was, we came up with this term, which I like it or hate it, but stuck, the Troubles, which is a very British way of describing it.
Yes, we had an interview with General Rose some time ago, and he disliked that term immensely. He said that no, it's a terrorist, in the sense that they are rebels.
Yes, I mean, it's a very good example of how language becomes so important. The reason I think Troubles, if you like, stuck in terms of the public imagination is that General Rose is absolutely correct. The IRA were terrorists. But from the British government's point of view, clearly, you know, their ambition was always to reach some form of agreement. And Troubles is one of those words that you can use without putting yourself in either camp. You know, you see this, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. You do have to be careful about language.
What's your relationship in Norway? Because you have been back and forth to Norway a lot, especially in the later years.
Yes, I mean, I'm extremely, you know, grateful how welcome I've been made here. I have to say, I do wish you'd change your law on the sale of wine, and your alcohol prices are still quite frightening, but I love you all dearly. In more recent years, I've been a member for a number of years of the Special Forces Club in London. The Special Forces Club was founded by members of the Special Operations Executive in 1945. And as most people listening to this will know better than I did, the Linger Company were honourable members of the club, really, from its very earliest days in 1945. As I, over the years, became more active, I was extremely fortunate to get to know people like Joachim Wannenberg, Erling Lorentzen, and that generation of Norwegians who made such a difference. So it's one of these classic examples I never set out to take, but the way events transpired, you know, one hugely respected the story. I mean, what I will say is, of all the countries with whom I've dealt in terms of their history, one of the things that I discovered very early on with Norway is you are probably the country that is most comfortable with its history. I mean by that, in Britain, we tend to create national heroes and then we knock them down. And there are any number of examples. In Norway, you had national heroes like Gunnar Sønsteby, Erling Lorentzen, you know, and they remain national heroes till the day they died. And, you know, the whole story of the... I know there are exceptions in terms of the Russian campaign and the far north that more study is being made of now, but I think you're more comfortable with the role of Milorg and the Linger Company and the liberation of Norway than most countries are. And also some of it was, I remember vividly, before he died, talking to Erling Lorentzen, and something he felt extremely strongly about was the critical role played by the Norwegian merchant marine in the Second World War. Now, to my shame, I had been unaware of that, and I was educated, and I used to arrange dinners where our patron, Her Royal Highness the Princess Royal, would speak, and I would submit speaking ideas, and I try, if I knew Erling was going to be in the audience, I would try and make sure the Princess Royal included a tribute to the role of the Norwegian merchant marine. Now, the Princess Royal has an intimate knowledge of naval history, merchant history, so I was pushing at an open door, but one was able to make very small I think it meant something to Erling that a member of the royal family paying tribute. And I've since, through contacts with organizations like the DNK and your Norwegian Shipowners Association, you know, I have come to understand, you know, the absolutely pivotal role the Norwegian merchant marine. And I think if we look back, you know, one of the great what-ifs in history is if your king had chosen to follow the Danish example and the Norwegian government hadn't decided to continue the fight from overseas. And this is where I have to tread extremely carefully because I'm not a historian. So, you know, I'm not suggesting we'd have lost the Second World War, but I think in terms of the Battle of the Atlantic, as an amateur historian, one wonders what we would have done, in particular if we hadn't had access to the Norwegian tanker fleet. So part of it, I was drawn in through being fortunate enough to meet people who'd actually play. I mean, Erling, as you know, was a member of Milorg, doesn't need me to tell Norwegian audience about Joker, but the opportunity to actually meet and get to know people who'd been there, done it, and would tell the story from the point of view of the guy who'd actually, that inevitably drew you in. And I say Norway, it so happened, and I don't want to be insulting to any of the nationalities that I dealt with, but somehow Norway, the individuals, always seemed to be that much more comfortable with their own story.
You get to know these people so close that you even made a speech at Joachim Rønneberg's funeral.
Yes, and I should apologize here to all Norwegian listeners that I am a typical Englishman. The appalling crime I'm committing to the Norwegian language, I apologize now. So, but yes, I mean, this was, I mean, I was going to use the word highlight, which is a slightly bad example on someone's funeral, but it was an incredible honour to be asked to speak at Joachim's funeral. Now that, I should stress, was not me as John Andrews. At the time, I was chairman of the Special Forces Club, and Joachim had always regarded his membership of the club as extremely important. Indeed, a high proportion of the photographs you'll see of him, he is actually wearing the club tie. And rather nice aside, he used to tell the story of coming back from Operation Gunnerside, sitting in front of the House of Commons or the Palace of Westminster, and he looked up and there was a Union Jack flying. And he told this story. We have an annual commemoration for SOE in the cloisters at Westminster, where the memorial to SOE is. And Joachim told this story. And one of the people listening to him was the clerk of the House of Commons, whose father had been a member of SOE as well. So he arranged for the Union Jack that was then flying to be taken down and present it to Joachim. Now, this is something the Americans do a lot. We don't. And it meant a lot to Joachim. So, but going back to the main point of your question, yes, it was an incredible honour to be at the cathedral in Allison and just to see, you know, the overwhelming respect that he was paid by your royal family and members of the government, and a very moving, you know, military tribute with people, you know, holding the war cross with swords at the front.
And you didn't even know that it was broadcasted?
No, that was a slight surprise, I have to confess. I was in the car. Your army were very kindly looking after me, and I'd never been to Allison before. And we were in the car, and one of my colleagues got a phone call, and I'd been asked to speak for, I can't remember, I think 10 minutes. And I was asked if I could perhaps cut it to 5. Not a problem for me. I never use a script. I just use headings. But the person who got the phone call said, look, I'll make it very clear that this is only the TV company that's asking. And I come out saying, what TV company? And somehow along the lines, I'd missed the fact that it was state funeral being broadcast live on television. So this was my one rather unexpected moment on television. And it was a great shock when one of my nephews discovered recording of it. So I thought I'd given a reasonably Churchillian speech and was suddenly confronted by this elderly white-haired man squeaking at the end of the church. So my advice to all people is never see a recording of yourself, because somehow any illusions that you were a Churchillian figure will be rapidly demolished within nanoseconds.
But the projects you are involved in here in Norway, can you tell us about the background and what end do we look at?
Yes, the history of the resistance in Norway at one level, it's very well known, whether you love it or hate it. You know, films like The Heroes of Telmark meant that Operation Gunnerside are well known, particularly in the UK. But interestingly, there was another side to the resistance that, through no fault of Norway, was largely unknown until very recently. And this was because whereas SOE was a standalone organization, the Linger Company was linked to SOE, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, there was another dimension that was run by MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service. Now, in Britain, until a few years ago, MI6 didn't exist officially. And we had to wait until a new generation of historians, when the MI6 became official, began to do research. Now, there was an absolutely crucial book written by a guy called Tony Insull, Dr. Tony Insull, who wrote a book called Secret Alliances. And this was really the first time that due recognition was paid to, in particular, those Norwegians, what we now call the Coast Watchers, who manned the very secret, very remote observation posts along the Norwegian coast. Now, I'm not the historian, but I think I'm correct in saying that in some cases they were providing intelligence on the movements of German shipping, including German naval ships, more quickly than Bletchley. And as I say, it was simply because MI6 had remained secret and you very kindly had respected the British policy that these people had become unknown. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Tony Ensor and myself felt that, you know, now was the moment that the Coast Watchers should receive a much higher level of public recognition. So Tony, as I say, Tony is a fluent Norwegian speaker, had worked in Oslo before, so has an intimate knowledge. I bring other skills to the party. But between us, we co-founded the Anglo-Norwegian Resistance Commemoration Project, which Her Royal Highness the Princess Royal agreed to become patron of. And indeed, we co-hosted a visit by Her Royal Highness to Norway in May. What we're aiming to do is to, if we can attract sufficient funding, is to build a statue which will represent the Coast Watchers, which ideally will be located somewhere in Oslo. Now, the Princess Royal was very kind enough to announce this, and our plan, our aim, is to have a competition between Norwegian sculptors, because whilst Tony and myself might be British, this is fundamentally aimed at commemorating Norwegians. Because while MI6 may have been the driving force organisationally, what we must never forget is all the incredibly brave people manning these observation posts were Norwegian. So for us, it's fundamental that the Norwegian statue is designed and built by Norwegians. In terms of the location, we very much hope, of course, that it will be somewhere in Oslo, ideally near the harbour. I mean, you could argue you should have it up in the country, but the trouble is the coast watching stations, by definition, were in some of the most remote places. So realistically, if you want to commemorate a class of activity, it needs to be somewhere where there will be a significant number of people walking past it.
I can imagine it's going to take a time for a proper location to be established, but it's a work in progress, as I understand. So is there any other project that you look at in Norway that are actually helping cement the close relationship between the UK and Norway?
I mean, fortunately, obviously, leaving aside the wartime history, there is a continuing very close relationship between the armed forces. It's well known that the British Royal Marines have trained in, you know, Norway for many years, and indeed, you know, because of what's going on in Ukraine and Russia at the moment, Anglo-Norwegian military relations are becoming even closer. But to give you an example of how old and new come together, one of the things that the Resistance Commemoration Project was able to do is Sir Richard Moore, who's chief of MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service. And I should say, the chief of the service only speaks in public incredibly rarely. But he agreed to come to Norway a few months ago, and he gave a speech, which is in the public domain. And that was the first time that a chief of SIS had publicly recognized the crucial importance of Norwegians to MI6 operations in Norway during the Second World War. So there you had an example of whilst what he was talking about was history, Sir Richard is the current chief of MIS, and he takes a very close interest in history and Norway. So you had old and new coming together. And I suppose the other area where, you know, I've been very lucky enough to watch is all the excellent work that has been done in Norway by the Gunnar Sundsvall Foundation. I've been lucky enough to be invited over the years to your annual award. And, you know, I think the work you're doing in the foundation in trying to make the history of the Linger Company, Milorg, and now the Watchkeepers, the Coast Watchers, relevant to the younger generation is crucial, because Coast Watchers, you know, if you're not careful, it obviously, in terms of the great scheme of things, was a niche, a very important niche. But sadly, with the passage of time, you know, we no longer have any veterans. And of course, a lot of these people, as was so typical during the war, didn't talk about it. So unless people consciously, like they have in Gunnarsundsvik and other areas, unless you consciously do the hard work, we are in danger of losing the history. And in fact, you know, we're already close to it being too late in terms of being able to talk to the people who were there.
So obviously, to get the recognition that we and you and everybody seeking in terms of this history commemoration is when, for example, the Princess Royal are engaging herself that much, and you brought her hit.
Yes, I should say, make it clear that the Her Royal Highness is an incredibly hard-working member of the royal family. So we were exceptionally fortunate that she agreed to become patron of the Anglo-Norwegian Resistance Commemoration Project. Now, that in part reflects the exceptionally close relationship between the British and Norwegian royal families. Indeed, Her Royal Highness is actually godmother to your Crown Prince. But as I say, it was a great honour for us, but even more important, a reflection of just how close the two royal families are. And of course, that goes back to the wartime relationship and your royal family being based on London. So I know, for example, Her late Majesty Queen Elizabeth, you know, very much regarded the older members of your royal family. She regarded them as family. But when the Princess Royal agreed to come here, and the program we put together was a reflection both of the importance of the history, but also we did try to look forward. So, for example, we took her to the superb museum at Valmok to see the new Gunnerside exhibition. As you know, surprisingly, everyone thought the bunker where the various nuclear centrifuges had been kept had been destroyed, but they discovered it hadn't been. So Princess Royal was able to go up and see that at first hand. But she was also able to meet the descendants of many of the key people. Now, Princess Royal is also patron of the Special Forces Club. And over the years, she had met people like Joachim Wannenberg and Erling Lawrence. And so for her, when she was talking about Operation Gunnerside, it wasn't, you know, talking about something that was remote. For her, you know, it was something where she had met the people and had an opportunity to sit. So with very, and I think I know some of the feedback we've got is how impressed they were at how knowledgeable Her Royal Highness was about the individuals. Now, Her Royal Highness is incredibly professional, but all I can say, it was also a reflection that for her, people like Joachim Wannenberg were not figures from academic history. They were people she had had the opportunity to meet over the years. Other areas, Her Royal Highness is also patron of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. One of the few things the Brits do actually get right, in my opinion, are our wartime graves around the world, almost anywhere. We have a tradition which lasted up to the Falklands War that you were buried where you fell. And there's an organization called the Commonwealth War Graves, which is quite phenomenal. Even in Gaza, for example, there was a First World War grave site that they managed to maintain. So it was extremely important for the Princess Royal to go to the cemetery in Oslo and see some of the graves of people from the UK who lost their lives. But an interesting area of where old and new came together is we took her to the Linger Club, where she was able to meet members of your armed forces who had been awarded the War Cross with Swords, I believe I'm right in saying. Now, Her Royal Highness has had a lifetime association with the British military. So for her, you know, I know that both meant a lot to her in terms of meeting the individuals, but it also meant a lot to her to be able to visit the Linger Club and the history of that, the fact that's where people were kept before they were executed, to see some of the historic exhibitions on display there. I know it's not open to the public, so you'll just have to take my word for it that that was extremely meaningful. But if you want to then jump ahead, we were very lucky that the Norwegian Ship Owners and the War Risk Association made their office available, and we took the Princess Royal there. So on the one level, she was briefed on what the Ship Owners and the War Risk Association do, keeping the current generation of Norwegian mariners safe. Her Royal Highness is very closely linked to the Royal Navy, Trinity House Association, so she was exceptionally interested. But at the same time, the DNK had very kindly purchased a painting by Serena Vivian Neal, a British artist, of the Coast Watchers. And the money they paid went towards the statue. So there was a nice, and that's now on display in their offices. So there was a nice example of, say, the Princess Royal was well aware of how important Norwegian sailors had been to the conduct of the Second World War. And it was very interesting for her to be able to meet the current generation of Norwegians who are playing their part in the Norwegian shipping industry, and of course the War Risk Association with what's going on the Red Sea. You know, people currently being exposed not to the same level of threat as the Second World War and the Battle of the Atlantic, but in principle, it's the same thing. Norwegian ship owners looking after their seamen and sea women. Not sure what the expression is now. But so from her point of view, the visit to Norway, and she had the opportunity, obviously, to meet the Norwegian royal family. But from her point of view, it was an opportunity to see at firsthand locations like Vermark, Commonwealth War Graves, of which she'd heard about through talking to people like Erling Lawrence and Joachim Wannenberg, but at the same time looking ahead through the opportunity to visit the ship owners and the DNK and hear the work that the current generation of Norwegians are doing to maintain that tradition of Norwegian seafarers.
In Friends and Allies, we hear the stories of some of our closest supporters, reliving with them some of their most intense moments, et øyeblikk, en evighet.